Hey, on Saturday, February 3rd, I'm doing a live panel here in LA at Largo at the Coronet with the writers from The Good Place, including creator Mike Shore and a whole bunch of the great writers, maybe all of them, who knows. It'll be a few days after the second season finale. Again, that's February 3rd. And it benefits Write Girl, a creative writing and mentoring organization that promotes creativity, critical thinking, and leadership skills to empower teen girls. You can get tickets and more information at largo-la.com. Please join us.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to the Writers Panel. I'm Ben Blacker, the creator and moderator of the podcast. I created the show because I wanted to talk to other writers about the business and process of writing. I've had more than 500 writers on the show, so please check the archives to find more writers and more TV shows of interest to you. I'm a writer myself, having written for Supernatural, Puss in Boots, and other programs. I have a couple of cool projects out this first quarter of 2017 that I hope you'll check out. One is a Supernatural Western comic book series from Boom Publishing that I wrote with my writing partner Ben Acker and our friend, the TV showrunner Andrew Miller. It's beautifully illustrated by Hannah Christensen, and the first issue is available in comic stores and online February 8th. In March comes the first book in a series of young adult novels that Acker and I wrote called Star Wars: Join the Resistance. It takes place just before The Force Awakens and is about a bunch of kids who join the fight against the First Order. But mostly they have adventures, fall in love with each other, and get in trouble. I hope you'll check out both of those projects. We're very proud of how they came out. Let me know who you'd like to hear on this podcast by following me on Twitter, at Ben Blacker, like the color, only more so, liking the Writers Panel on Facebook, and visiting writerspanel.tumblr.com. And if you like the show, please leave a review on iTunes. Reading those reviews really provides a pick-me-up.
They write, they talk, and talk about what they write. Tune in tonight, or whenever the time is right. It's the Writers Panel with Ben Blacker, and it's starting now. Oh, yeah!
That's really
what this is for. Listen, we're in a windowless office with no furniture. I'm sure you're grievances.
We don't even have all the panels. They're now taking panels slowly from us.
This is like a scene from Seven.
Really, yeah.
Sick. You guys, thank you so much for being here. I have been saying it publicly. I will say it to your faces. I love the Exorcist television program. You guys are really doing great work. I'm sorry nobody's watching.
Thank you.
It's the story of our lives.
But it really is good, and I sincerely hope that people will sort of find it.
Thank you.
As I know people did find the first season. So why don't you introduce yourselves, starting with you, Jeremy, so people can differentiate your voices, and then we'll get into it.
I'm Jeremy Slater. This is my voice. I am one of the executive producers.
I am Sean Crouch. I am also one of the executive producers.
All right. Jeremy, you are credited with sort of creating, developing the show for Fox.
Right.
How did you become that guy?
I was on the feature side of things for like 10 years, running on that kind of treadmill where you're one of 20 writers on a terrible superhero movie or a terrible horror movie or something like that. And it was really fun, but at the same time, it's you have zero ownership over anything you do. I mean, I have my name on movies where I literally have three words of dialogue in the entire film. So it was fun and the money's good, but there was kind of zero pride in the end result. And everyone said, come to TV. TV is fun. TV, you don't get fired and replaced 20 times. You can actually stay on a project from beginning to end. And so I had my agents start sniffing around for projects that were interesting. And they came to me with the idea of Morgan Creek was developing The Exorcist as a show. And they said, are you interested? And I said, no, that's a terrible idea. I'm not going to do that, and you shouldn't do it either. And then after I hung up the phone and started thinking about it, pieces started to kind of fall into place. Because the original plan was to just remake the film. And I told them, and they had tried to develop it for like a year or two and tried to get it off the ground. And I was like, that's a terrible idea. Because you're never going to tell that particular story better. You're only going to tell it longer.
So how do you start talking, whether it's Morgan Creek or whether it's the network, into there's a better way to do this, which clearly there
yeah,
is.
It was all in collaboration with Morgan Creek because I told my agent, give him a call, be like, look, he has no interest in trying to top William Friedkin, but he thinks there's something here, and so they were very happy to sit down with me, and we kind of bounced ideas around in a preliminary meeting, and I went off and kind of based off that meeting, kind of wrote. A 5-page document, which was basically the first 3/4 of season one. It was the family, it was the two priests. I had the twist pretty early on that it was actually kind of a stealth sequel to the movie, but I was very deliberate to not tell anyone, including really? Fox, including Morgan Creek. I kept that very hidden, just to give myself wiggle room, just so... If I chickened out and lost my nerve, I could always walk it back. And also I knew that as soon as you tell someone the big twist, they're like, that's great. Let's put it in the pilot.
Yeah, I think that's a good reason not to tell. But it also felt to me, just in watching the series, that like, yeah, it's kind of going along, right? And you're getting a great exorcist story. You're getting great exorcism stuff. And it in many ways felt like the movie, which I think was probably something you were trying to do. But when that twist comes in the first season, that to me felt like a selling point. So it's so interesting to hear that you didn't tell them that.
Well, I understand the need for marketing, especially seeing our numbers in the ratings. Marketing would be a good thing. And the reality is that if we had ended that first pilot episode with "My name is Reagan McNeil," we probably would have gotten more buzz. We probably would have gotten more eyeballs. We may be in a different position here. But, you know, I felt at the time, and I still believe that... you would never have built up any sort of emotional attachment to that family and those characters. You wouldn't have cared about Casey Rance being possessed because it would have immediately just become a story about Reagan McNeil's daughter is possessed versus this brand new character. I just knew that if you don't fall in love with these characters, if you don't get emotionally invested in the core possession storyline for each season, then it's just a series of people levitating and speaking in weird voices and shit flying around the room, and it's very it just becomes empty spectacle. And so if you can't get them hooked early on, why are you doing this to begin with? So, you know, I'm also a fan of the twist. I think that's one of the big joys of writing, is to be able to do that sleight of hand magic trick and to try to trick people. We did it last year. We tried to do it this season as well with a couple twists. When you pull it off, it's really, really fun. When you're sitting there watching people lose their shit on Twitter in real time, and you're like, I got him. It's a great feeling. It's as close as most of us will ever get to being M. Night Shyamalan or something like that, and sitting in the back of the theater and hearing everyone in the theater just go, oh, shit, at the same time. It's very addictive. Like, I've never experienced that before. Right. And then it's like, oh yeah, you know, now we got to chase the dragon. Get that feeling again and again.
I agree. I mean, that it would not be as effective if it were a marketing tool, right? It would feel like a knockoff of The Exorcist rather than part of the whole.
Right.
Right.
I want to talk about sort of the design of each of these seasons and sort of talk about the second season specifically. Was the design to have, you know, an exorcism per season?
Yes. From the beginning, I said, you know, we're going to approach each season as a 10-hour movie. Because I don't think you can stretch this past 10 episodes. I think once you start talking about 13 or 16, you're going to be spinning your wheels. Because if you go back and look at the original film, there's probably 10 to 15 minutes of actual exorcism in the movie The Exorcist.
It's the final act, and that's about it.
That's about it. And we kind of tend to have 10 to 15 minutes per episode in a lot of these, in some of these seasons. So you always kind of run the risk of as soon as these demons become non-threatening, as soon as it's not scary, it's kind of the risk that any horror show has, where the more you kind of shove a zombie or a werewolf or a ghost in someone's face, the more familiar you kind of become with its tricks, and the harder it becomes to make them scary or memorable. So we said from the beginning, each season will have one sort of central case, and that's your emotional investment in the season. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the exorcists, the priests, and this larger conspiracy storyline will carry on from year to year, because I had no interest in doing American Horror Story and just kind of hitting a reset button every year. You need to give the audience a reason to come back.
Well, and you've got these compelling actors.
Right. Yeah, and that's the other thing, is saying goodbye to Ben Daniels and Alfonso Herrera would be this, like, how do you replace them? How do you find two better exorcists every single year? It'd be impossible.
I think ratings-wise, you know, maybe if we had done more of the CBS model, where it was an exorcism of the week, you know,
which
CSI exorcist.
People expected.
I think ratings wise, that might have maybe ratings would be. I think the ratings would be higher, but I think it would have dropped off because it's so less satisfying.
Absolutely.
I mean, even this season, we tried at the beginning of the season. We gave because we needed creatively. We needed to spread out, and we wanted to watch the seduction of John Cho's character over the course of a longer time, which we didn't get to see in season one. So we have an exorcism in the first two episodes, and then the third episode we sort of have a third exorcism of the week that ends up not being an exorcism, which was fun, and it was fun to play in that sandbox for those three episodes. But then, really, as we did with the A story with John Cho's character in the first three episodes, I mean, really, that's the satisfying.
Yeah.
And then when you get to the end of the season, that's what you want to see.
Yeah. Well, this is, I mean, just coming off of what you guys were saying in the second season, and we have seen, right? We've lived through the first. We've seen exorcisms. We've seen what these demons can do. We've seen kind of what the rules of this world are. How do you, in the second season, start to change that? You know, what were the conversations that took place, Sean, when you came in?
I think the biggest one for me, and it was like our very first meeting, we immediately had the exact same ideas going forward. But I think one of the biggest ideas that I sort of mentioned before was, let's see the seduction of our main character, and using the twist of grace along the way. We're obviously, this is spoiled, right? This is okay.
This is, we should say, like, we're going to assume you've seen all of season one,
right?
Season two up to episode nine, and the finale is this week, and people can watch it.
So we wanted to play with which of our five kids are possessed, and we don't know, because we're expecting last season where we didn't see really Casey's seduction. You see the salesman a little bit early on. So this time we wanted to show how a man could sell his soul from almost Jump Street all the way through the grace, and then when he rejects that demon, then the demon then changes to his wife and really hits him harder with that. So that's really one of the main things we changed from last season, is to see this. I mean, he's really not fully possessed until the end of episode 7, really, all the way through. So we waited, whereas last season was, what, halfway through the pilot, basically, right? That Casey's up in the attic.
Yeah, yeah. The demon's in season one, so by the first episode,
yeah. So if we had done that this season, if Andy had been possessed from the first season, I don't know where. There's five episodes of TV. I have no idea what. It's a blank. It's a test pattern.
The guessing game was a lot of the fun, too. I mean, you get to have all those misleads and build the characters at the same time. So let's talk about, like, the milieu of this second season and where this even came from. I mean, I think the first, again, felt only in retrospect very safe, and that was a suburban family. It was thing we recognized tied to the movie. So for the second season, again, where did you guys start?
The one thing I knew even last year is that if we get a second year, if we're lucky enough to get a second season, I really wanted the central possessed person to be male.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to try it in season one, but then I knew once I had the Regan McNeil twist, I was like, you know what, it's thematically better if it's Regan's daughter who's possessed instead of Regan's son. It's going to be an easier misdirect to make the audience look over here at Casey, pay no attention to Angela standing over here in the shadows. But it's something we discussed a lot in our writer's room last year. We discussed it a lot in our room this year, which is there's just a lot of misogyny built into the exorcism genre as a whole. It's always about kind of the virginal, innocent, helpless woman who's kind of being defiled and invaded and filled up by this masculine you know, rapey presence, and the only person who can save her are two kind of celibate male right. priests who are going to kind of come in and lecture her on all the evil she's done. and you know, and some of that's not to kind of blame Blatty or blame the original story. It's more to blame the sort of 40 years of of copycats and knockoff imitations.
These have become the tropes.
They're tropes at this point.
I didn't even go back even 500 years to Catholicism. I mean, it's priests. It literally is priests.
We'll blame the Bible.
that's where it grows from.
Perfect.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of thematic elements packed into this. There's a lot of you know, gender politics packed into this from the beginning, but also from the movie on.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so we kind of said, you know, if we came back for a year or two and our central possessed person was another, you know, 20-year-old white blonde girl, it would feel like that we are kind of embracing these tropes as opposed to trying to take them in new directions. Mm-hmm. And so we just talked a lot about what conceptually excited us and the idea of doing an adult as opposed to a teenager or a child. And once you have a male adult, the idea of doing a father was something that, you know, we all kind of creatively jumped at very early, because you have to have a strong family structure is what we've learned in breaking these stories. If you take the guy who has no family and no friends and no kids and he becomes possessed, no one gives a shit, because no one's you have to see someone rooting for this guy to get saved. It's why, if you're doing Independence Day or some movie like that, you always have to keep cutting back to the people on the ground who are kind of watching the spaceships blow up and cheering to let the audience know that, like, yes, this is something to cheer for. So all the pieces just kind of started clicking together that this is needs to be a story about a family, and then how do we make this a different kind of family than we had last year? I don't remember who it was in our writer's room to give credit to, but someone threw out the idea of foster kids on the first or second day of brainstorming, and we all just kind of latched onto it as a way to tell a different kind of story about, you know, the family that you build potentially being stronger than the family that you're born with. It felt like new ground for us to explore versus the sort of generic nothing is stronger than the power of love stuff that you kind of default to when you're doing stories like this. Sure.
And as a father, it was very important to me. I think in our very first meet we talked about, as a father, it was very important to me to think about what would I sell my soul for. I would sell my soul for my kids or for my wife.
Or a Klondike bar.
So I think that's one way we came into this, saying how could we, which we see in episode 7, we finally see, and I hope that one reason people find episode 7 scary is because they start to say, oh, I would make those choices. Mm-hmm. I would, sort of like Breaking Bad for me was, what I love about Breaking Bad is every choice he made until basically the last season, I would make that same choice.
Yeah.
Every single time I would say, oh, I would do that. And so that's what we tried to do throughout the course of Andy's seduction, especially into episode 7.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you have to... Storytelling is about choices, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And about justifying the choices for your character. So the season was broken. You had the room together already. Were you walking into season 2 with ideas already, or was it really formed in the room?
Vague, half-baked ideas. I knew that the character Mouse was going to get introduced. I knew that she had a history and a past with Marcus, because that's something that we had discussed in our room last year as an interesting kind of B or C plot that we never found a way to kind of bring that in. There was just never time in season 1. So we always said, you know, if we come back, let's explore more of his past. Let's explore more of Marcus's sexuality. Like, I had kind of like a checklist of the things that we never got to play with last year. But in terms of the central possession storyline, I knew the person was male, and I knew it was adult, and beyond that, we kind of had nothing.
That's a great location. Piece of the room, right?
Yeah.
Did you have a location? You know, going back to your earlier question,
we didn't have a say in the location.
It wasn't our choice. They said, I came in, they said, you are shooting in Vancouver. Uh-huh. So we said, all right, Vancouver, Seattle, big Asian American population, big immigrant population for our foster family. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make sure that what we did with diversity this season was just normal. That mm-hmm. we wanted to show you this was just a normal thing. It doesn't feel like we're doing diversity because no. it just feels like we're doing just this is normal. And I think the Pacific Northwest, you get a lot more of that feeling. And then I know that we're obviously huge horror fans and the using nature. You know, as you said, last year was urban and sort of safe. Now we put them on an island and we isolate them and we use nature to tell our story this season to give us, again, a different, you know, to use a lot of greens and blues. Versus sort of the whites and the blacks of last, even color scheme, and our directing producer even came in with ideas about how changing the color scheme and the lighting over the course of the season even changed.
That's really neat.
One of our big creative references this season, even though we had to lie in all our interviews because it would have given away the twist, and so we had to be like, oh no, it's all we're taking inspiration from J horror and from Poltergeist and just lying through our teeth. But it was The Shining. The Shining was the reference we kept bringing up, and you can't tell anyone because once you're like, hey, it's the story of a father who goes crazy and attacks his kids, it kind of gives away the twist a little bit. But, you know, the thing that makes The Shining one of the best horror movies ever is the way it embraces its location and the way it takes that isolation and makes it a physical threat almost. Yeah. It's this ever-present claustrophobia that's constantly closing in on you, even though you're in this sort of wide open, expansive, natural environment, it feels so incredibly claustrophobic. And so that's something we looked at. How do we do that on the page? How do we do that in our storytelling? And obviously, how do we translate that to screen with our directors?
Yeah. I mean, I think the latter is certainly, you know, that's the most obvious, right? Yeah, this show in this season especially has this amazing lived-in quality. Like the house that those people live in.
Yeah.
That's a house where people live.
The Stanley. Or the Overlook. I mean, that's sort of what I called it myself. We called it the Overlook Hotel, the Stanley Hotel. Can you remember which one's in the movie? Which one's real? Is it the Overlook?
The Overlook is the name of it. It's just shot at the Stanley.
At the Stanley, okay, yeah. So that's what we sort of thought that was our.
Yeah. Which can be both so welcoming and so terrifying. Right. And it's got these great shadows and corners and attics and things. But it's the choice to sort of play that claustrophobia and that isolation on the page that I'm curious about. You know, how do you guys as writers get that across? What do your scripts look like?
For this show, we have to, because it's this show, it takes place in the real world. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't a superhero show or Outlander out on Mars. Outlander. You know, this the Sean Connery Outlander.
Oh, okay. Not the new Outlander.
Sorry, not the new Outlander.
I haven't seen either, but I know one doesn't take place on Mars.
So part of that is we're trying to write in a almost a drama space. And then all of a sudden we insert demons into the drama. So I think that's where we get some of our claustrophobia from.
We also had, because we had this twist where, you know, we're introducing our salesman character right from the beginning and kind of hiding our salesman in plain sight, but instead of a creepy gentleman in a suit, it's an adorable 5-year-old girl.
Pretty creepy, though.
She's an incredibly creepy.
The pillowcase.
Right. Which should throw you off the case, right? You're like, there's no way that she's too creepy to be the demon. Which was our thinking going into it. Like, how do we throw people off?
You find yourself asking the whole time.
Yeah.
Like, there's such unease in those first 5-6 episodes.
Well, and that's what was tricky for us to kind of crack, because when you're telling a story about someone's sanity unraveling, but you're also trying to make his madness a surprise to some extent and a twist, you have to be very careful. And it's why, you know, we had a lot of issues and a lot of things to discuss with our writers, with the studio and the network early on how isolated do you make this character? Do you give him friends? Does he have people on the island? Does he have a day job that he's going to? And there was a lot of push to kind of broaden his world a little bit. And the one thing we always clung to is the more we can isolate him, the more you can make this guy incredibly lonely without the audience realizing that he's incredibly lonely. That's going to help the twist land. Because if you go back and rewatch those first 4 episodes, hopefully you see all the places where you realize, like, oh shit, this guy is he's grieving. This is a guy in stasis whose life basically ended when his wife's life ended, and he still hasn't moved on. He's still kind of living in this limbo. And the trick was to try to kind of design scenes that played like normal, happy father where everything's okay. And then you go back and watch it with a fresh set of eyes and you realize like, oh, it is pretty unhealthy that this guy is just spending all day long picking up after kids and walking around this creepy island by himself.
Yeah. The thing you mentioned is the great trick, especially the first half of the season is... We know we're watching The Exorcist, right? But it seems like there's nothing wrong here. And we get, you guys sort of play the drama in a B story, you play the horror in a B story.
Sure.
You know, you get this other stuff going on to sort of...
My favorite trick of
distract,
this,
which is amazing.
My favorite trick of this whole season is that what you're talking about is that we're watching a man who wants to help children.
Mm-hmm.
And he is most successful with Grace. Mm-hmm. This is an agoraphobic little girl who won't even leave her room. He finally, in episode 2, gets her out of her room. In episode 3, he gets her outside a little bit, but there's some bad things he gets her. Finally, episode 4, he's successful. And if this was a drama, it would be a beautiful moment. You'd have the scores playing, and they're outside dancing and the thing. And then Verity comes and sees him. Obviously, we don't see it, but he's by himself. And then he goes upstairs. She doesn't exist. So it's and we tried to do this over and over the season, tried to give you, if this was a normal drama, we give you these beautiful moments, moments of absolute beauty and success, and then you realize that's a demon's lie. And it should be really scary when you go back and look at it again. Like, it's wow, that's how they get you.
Right. Well, it's totally, you're playing it totally subjective.
Right, yeah,
you're,
exactly.
You're with John Cho's character. Yes. I want to ask just briefly about the casting. This cast is phenomenal.
Yes.
They're so good.
We're so lucky.
Yeah. Amazingly lucky. Every single one is a home run.
Yeah.
Every single
And you're building,
cast.
Again, other than the priest, you're building this from scratch in the second season. Did you have people in mind? Was Cho mentioned early? Did you have
we had one person
types
in mind.
In mind? Is that right?
We had one person in mind. For the first 3 weeks, I think, up on our board, you know, you break your episodes on the board, you use the character's name. So, you know, Verity goes to school. Every time we had Andy Kim, that's the character's name, it was just John Cho.
Hilarious.
We said, John Cho comes home. John Cho's with Grace. John Cho makes...
Danger.
Right. And that's, we should say, like, this is a thing that writers do.
They do.
Like, say,
yes.
Here's the casting. We don't know who this guy is yet, but we love this.
We love...
Actor.
This is the idea of what we want. And then we're like, well, we better go out to him. Because if he says no, I don't know what we're going to do.
Yeah. Well, and my question was sort of about...
Yeah.
And finding out that he wasn't involved from the beginning is like, once you approach an actor like that, you have the story, right? You're not... He knows he's the one who's going to be possessed. He knows the term.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
We had a meeting with him. We got a...
Tuna melts.
Tuna melts.
Excellent.
At Cafe 101.
Really excellent tuna melts. I think that's what sold him.
Holy shit, the lights just went out.
You guys
just went out.
You're on brand.
Exorcist shit is happening.
So you sort of sold him the season.
You kind of have.
Here's the character.
When you're dealing with, like, the A-listers, you kind of have to. It was the same with Gina Davis in season 1. Like, we had to come in and really pitch her that you're not just going to be playing the sort of Chris McNeil role from the original movie where you're concerned mother, and then you get kind of pushed to the side and someone else comes in to save the day and you're just crying in the hallway outside the room, that you're going to have an actual arc to your character and that... You actually get to play the villain at some point. I think that's an appeal for a lot of actors. I mean, Gina Davis has had this incredible career, and over the course of, 30 years, she's never once been offered a villain role.
Yeah, that's funny.
And she's fucking awesome at it. Like,
absolutely.
if you watch season 1, she's so good at being scary. And it's just, you know, it's an itch that they haven't gotten to scratch in some cases. And for John, it was really, you know, we talked about, you're going to be playing the world's best father, and then you're going to be playing this guy spiraling into grief and madness, and then you're going to be playing, you know, Jason Voorhees to some extent. So it's going to be three kind of radically different characters over the course of 10 episodes. We're going to take this guy on a real journey.
I think that's another, that's a good lesson too for writers, is like, you're writing for actors, and actors want to do stuff.
Mm-hmm. They do.
Give them stuff to play.
And they want to do stuff they haven't done before, yeah. is another thing, because, you know, when we were putting together sort of our preliminary lists of who do we like, when we were starting to talk about the role of Andy, it was like, well, who are those actors we're not sick of? Who are those actors who you know, because you can go offer something to Kiefer Sutherland or something, right, like that, but it's like,
you've seen him,
I've seen him on TV for the last 20 years, and he's great, but it's like, there's not that level of excitement, whereas you take, so we kind of sat down on our first day, and it was like, who do we love? Who's that guy who's awesome? And you're happy every time he shows up in something, and you always want just a little bit more. Like, let's find that guy, and let's give him a little bit more. Let's build an entire season around taking one of these guys who we know he can dramatically handle this. Mm-hmm. And look, John brought this season to life in so many ways, I think.
Like, we knew he could do it, but then he went beyond.
Yeah.
He went beyond. I mean, if 5 million people a week watched this show, they'd be talking about him for Emmys,
sure,
right now. Everyone would be talking about him for Emmys.
And I think that's true of the whole cast.
Absolutely.
You know, they are really bringing this thing to life. You believe the humanity of these characters, which is really necessary for selling this kind of thing. I want to just sort of take a sidebar here and talk about horror in general and The Exorcist specifically. You talked a little bit about some of the tropes that have become associated with The Exorcist or exorcism stories. But when you're looking at the first season, when you're looking at the original movie and sort of saying, what can I take out of that, whether it's thematic or visual, what was the stuff that you thought about that you talked with the writer's room about?
I mean, when I was sitting down just figuring out how to crack it, as how to translate it to television in the first place, to me, what was more interesting was the question, was sort of the questions of faith and morality and spirituality. To me, that was unexplored territory in terms of television. You don't see a lot of characters kind of grappling with faith and mm-hmm. talking about these big issues. There's plenty of shows with possessions or with demons or ghosts or supernatural spirits and exorcisms and cleansing rituals. Supernatural does 3 or 4 of them a year and does them well, but it's you're never going to reinvent the wheel with something like that. So my pitch was always, this has to be a drama first and foremost and a horror show secondary. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, which I didn't realize coming into this because I was a total rookie to the world of television, is the sort of production schedule that you're talking about. You have 8 days to shoot a 45-minute movie, essentially.
Yeah.
And we knew that in order to do justice to The Exorcist name, it needed to feel like a movie. You can't crap this out and make it, look like just kind of a slick, glossy...
Yeah.
Don't say another show. I'm trying so hard not to insult other shows.
It can't look like a network show.
Exactly.
And it doesn't.
If it looked super slick and phony, you would lose that level of realism. And so it's very hard to pull that off in 8 days, in 42 pages of script. So the thing that you have to learn is how to be judicious with your scares, how to kind of mm-hmm. parcel them out, because, you figure you have 8 days of shooting, a good scare sequence is going to take all day. It's going to be a solid 14 hours of filming to get something with the proper level of coverage and atmosphere and everything else. And so if you have 2 scares in your episode, that may take up 3 minutes of screen time, but now you have to get the other 42 minutes of your episode in 6 days. And if you want 3 scares, it's going to compress your schedule even more. And so you have to be very smart about, there are other horror shows on TV that on cable and in other places that have the luxury of shooting 20 day episodes. And we don't have that. So the only way this was ever going to work is if we were a drama first and foremost. And that means really kind of leaning into the things that make the original Exorcist interesting to me, which is, less about the little girl floating off the bed and more about Karras trying to figure out whether or not he's fucked up his entire life by joining the priesthood and an atheist like like Chris McNeil, trying to reconcile the fact that her daughter's bed is bouncing up and down for no reason. Like, to me, that's kind of the interesting stuff. And so that's always been our approach in the writer's room, which is kind of like, tell the drama first and foremost. Don't worry about the scares. We have enough sick and twisted minds behind the scenes that can go take these dramatic scripts and figure out the place to drop a nightmare sequence or to drop a really tense kind of interrogation sequence. But if the drama doesn't work, there's no reason to come back week after week. Then you just kind of wind up with exploitation TV and the audience gets bored and moves on.
Yeah. The only problem with that we found, and I think we have a great solution for it, was that's great for most of your episodes. Then you get to episodes 9 and 10 at the end of the season. Yeah. 9, you are now owed Jason Voorhees running through the forest trying to kill his children. You know? And you're not going to have a scene where they break for tea halfway through and talk about character stuff.
You can't let up
that
moment.
Yeah, so that script was 38 pages.
Yeah.
Because it's just action and then the finale has everything in it, as you'll see coming up this week. Yeah. It has...
Nice plug. 9 p.m. on Fox.
Also buy soap.
Well, and the other thing that you have no idea when you're just sitting there, because I didn't, when you're just sitting there watching as a TV viewer, you kind of just assume that the finale is the easiest episode to do because you have all year to plan it and you know you get it right. And what you don't realize is every other episode leading up to your last two, if you fuck something up, if you don't make your day, then those missing scenes just get bumped to a second and your second unit goes and shoots something while another episode is taking place.
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh, well, we only got half of our scenes on this day, but don't worry, Jason Enzo will pick it up next week. And then you get to the last two episodes of the year, which are the most important, and the second episode 10 finishes wrapping, no one gets paid anymore. Like, everyone's contracts end literally at midnight on that. On the last day
or
of filming.
2:30 a.m.
Or, yeah, sure.
You wrapped at 2:30 a.m.
2:30 a.m.
Saturday
like,
morning. Or Sunday
people
morning.
People just put
Sunday
their
morning.
Stuff down and walk away because, God bless them, they've been working nonstop for 6 months.
Yeah.
And your actors hop on planes and they fly back to wherever they live and people start taking sledgehammers to all the sets and everything. So it's like anything you don't get in those last two episodes, you just don't get. It just doesn't exist. And that's the kind of stuff that when you're just sitting there on the couch, like, yelling at your TV, but why didn't that happen? It's the shit that I had no idea about before I jumped to television.
Yeah. Well, that's why you're here.
Right. Yeah, partly.
Sean, I mean, you've been doing this for a while.
I have. Yeah.
You've worked on a number of shows that have sort of lasted.
Literally numbers.
Number of numbers.
What did you take from all these experiences that you bring to sort of producing this show?
Like this show, this show is the hardest show I've ever produced.
What?
It's also the most satisfying. It's also the best. I think it's because we are, everyone's so passionate. We want every episode, and I think we have successfully so far, every episode has been better than the last because it's built on the last. Creatively, production-wise, the look, the actors, every single person brings it and gets better and better. And Verity, better. You know, I think Verity in episode 8, I think that's the best performance that Brianna Hildebrand's had this entire season. She's been great this whole season, but she killed it in 208. You know, and so every performance gets better and better. And we turn in these scripts. Even a 39-page script is really, when they board it out, it's really a 12-day shooting schedule. And we only have 8 days to shoot it. And somehow we have to fit that in. And on this show, it's because no one is willing to compromise. Mm-hmm. On the show, including the network and the studio, no one's willing. They say, fine, you know what, do it. We will make it happen. We will spend the money. We will find this. Mm-hmm. And as a producer, that kills me. You know, because it should be a lot easier than that.
Yeah.
But creatively, it's well worth it.
Yeah,
and that's why.
It seems it. I mean, it's funny. I mean, we talk about shortcuts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell every step of the way that shortcuts are not taken on this show.
Right.
And on the best shows, like the shows that we love, there are no shortcuts.
Yeah.
There's no hand waving. And it seems like that would be the way to tell a story. And you know, most of network TV is not that.
Right. Well, it's just part of the beast of network TV.
I guess it is.
You have 43 minutes and 45 seconds because the rest of that is commercials,
mm-hmm.
and you just need people to keep coming back and watching the show. And you know, just to have everybody, to have 100% of people not compromise and not willing to compromise on this show is why it's so good.
Is it possible, I'm going to ask you to get a little heady here, but is it possible that network is or could move towards a cable model where so much of the writing is getting done up front before production starts?
I think it would. Yeah, it would be smart. I think they're doing it to some extent. I know that they gave Star and Empire early renewals, and kind of as soon as they wrapped their seasons, they immediately rolled their writers into new. Because it is like, look, the only reason our show exists is because of how good our writers' room was. Because our schedule was impossible. We had from our first day sitting down to start brainstorming and saying, what should this season be about? We had 8 days to figure out the season before we had to start breaking episode one.
We had to go pitch it. We had to go pitch Fox 8 days later. Jeremy and I had to go in and say, here's our entire season.
Yeah.
And what if they had said no?
That happens. And they did say no to a few things. And some of them we agreed with, and some we pushed back on and said, you know what, let us do the first five and we'll come back and sort of pitch out the end a little bit.
And the same thing happened on year one, honestly. We had the exact same thing where, you know, I got the call to start writing the pilot and had to have the pilot written 5 days later, and then we were casting the next week. It was like it happened that fast, and then everything stopped for like 3 months so that they could test, and then once they decided to pick up the show and hire everyone, by the time you close all the deals and find a writer space and move everyone in, you have 8 days. And you have 8 days to figure out what's going to happen. And so, you know, last year, this is inside baseball here, but like last year, we had no idea how the season was going to end. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it kind of bit us on the ass a little bit. It did not end in the satisfying way that I was hoping. Mm-hmm. We weren't able to bring all of the different plot threads together. And it's because we kind of tried to deliberately go A to B to C to, you know, we'll get episode six, great, then we'll worry about episode seven. And so one of the things we try to do differently this year that got a lot of pushback from different people, because it's not the way television works or network TV works, but we said, we're going to hit the ground running. We're going to generate material as quickly as we can. Mm-hmm. Because if we can get first drafts in your hands, we can have start someone working on the next first draft, and then the next first draft after that, and then Sean and I can be going back behind the scenes and making these better before they actually air. But we're going to race against the clock. So we had episode 10 kind of mapped out while we were sort of still writing episode 5. Mm-hmm. Whereas last year, we were figuring out 10 while 9 was being written.
It was one foot.
So
did this different approach work?
But what we found out is that it's not done in network television.
Right.
The, you know,
it caused problems from some.
And it caused problems, you know, because people are used to getting scripts in pristine fashion and give it to us 3 days before it's due, or 3 days before it has to be finished, as opposed to 3 weeks early. Yeah. Once you start handing things in very quickly, and suddenly there's six scripts sitting on someone's desk, it becomes very easy to just kind of get overwhelmed or something. So I think there are models that need to change a little bit to emulate what cable does, mm-hmm. where on cable there's a lot more of you go off and write 10 scripts in seclusion, mm-hmm. and bring them back, and then we will judge all 10 scripts at once.
Right.
And then you'll go shoot all 10 in a row, where, you know, network still, you're kind of preparing your meal while you eat it. You're writing it while you shoot it, while you edit it.
Well, I think that approach asks for a different kind of note, too, right? Like, you're giving this to executives and saying, we're giving you a broad view of story.
Yes.
These scripts are not done. Don't give me line notes. Which I think is valuable.
Yes, right? and to be perfectly clear, we're the ones who fucked up, not the network.
Because we
didn't have those preliminary conversations.
Yeah.
We were just like, here's some scripts, we're going to keep going, don't worry about it. And they all freaked out because they were like, oh, well, some of these scripts suck. And we're like, yeah, don't worry about it.
It wasn't quite that bad.
The communication problem was definitely on our end. So I'm not trying to throw anyone under the bus, but I am saying that in an ideal world, everyone would sort of follow the Netflix model, where you go off, you get the scripts right, you figure out the entire arc of the season, and then you hand them in, you make sure everyone's creatively happy, and then right. you go off to shoot it. But this year, because Sean and I worked at such a fast pace, we were much closer to that, which means I think our finale this year is much better than our finale last year. There's stuff that ties into the very first episode in 9 and 10.
Yeah.
There are there are visual callbacks. There yeah. are line, character line art callbacks. Line callbacks. There are character arcs that are getting tied right. up.
Even while we were shooting, Jeremy and I both went up for episode 1. And even while we were sitting there watching episode 1, and I can't tell you because episode 10 is airing this Friday, 9 p.m. on Fox. There were things that we were watching. We said, oh, here's what we owe in episode 10. Yeah. We sat there and we started writing down scenes that we owe that are in the final cut that we just watched. And look, your mileage may vary, but if you've watched, I think you will find this season is extremely satisfying. And if it's the last episode of The Exorcist, I hope it's not, but if it's the last episode of The Exorcist, I think you will be satisfied.
That's great. Yeah. I want to ask you guys just a couple of specific sort of story yeah. choices sure. that went into this Please. Season and maybe the conversations that happened around them. The first of which is about going into these characters' backgrounds. You know, we got to see a lot of sort of the other priest last season, what he was dealing with, and he got to be this sort of, like, mysterious priest right. guy.
Right.
This season we get to learn a little bit more about him, but I feel like it's doled out in a really, like, you almost hold it back even while doling it out. What were the conversations around that? I mean, you said you came into the season, Jeremy, knowing you wanted to explore a little bit more about him.
Yeah, I mean, look, we knew in year one that Marcus was a bisexual character because we had built him with Ben Daniels. We sat there before we even went off and shot the pilot, and Rollin Jones, the season one showrunner, and I, we and Rupert Wyatt would just have hour-long conversations about where did you come from? What are the meaning behind your tattoos? What do you think happened after you shot your father in the face with a hunting rifle? What happened in that boy's home? How did you get inducted into the priesthood? So we kind of built his entire story, and then it's just a question of when do you parcel that out? What do you save as a mystery versus, you know, some giant exposition dump? We also had problems in year one. We did a flashback early on in episode 2 that was not our most successful moment. It was terrible. And it really kind of scared us off from doing flashbacks for the rest of the season. We had more planned, and we kind of walked back from the ledge. And then we came in this year and we're like, okay, we need these flashbacks because this guy is so fascinating. You want to figure out yeah. what makes the characters you love tick. Where did they come from? So then it was always a question of, you know, are we finding a child actor who can play young Ben Daniels, or can we get the technology to kind of digitally de-age him and do the sort of right. Marvel Captain yeah. America Iron Man de-aging thing? And so even some of those ideas were in flux until we had those visual effects right. conversations to figure out, is this something you can do on a TV budget and a TV schedule? Can we shoot a flashback version where Ben Daniels is 20 years younger than he actually is and not have it look ridiculous? And it wasn't until we kind of had those first tests that we knew that we could actually go for it on the page.
I mean, that came from Ben. My very first conversation with Ben ever. I love Ben. He's the best actor in the world to work with. He'll send me 10-page emails, you know, and it's really in-depth and it's great. But we had the three of us had a two-hour Skype conversation with Ben. We talked about everything in the show, and I think we mentioned the word flashback once halfway through the conversation. The next morning, I woke up to probably a 20-page email from Ben about why flashbacks didn't work in season 1. Yeah. They don't wow. work. Don't do it. And so, that changed our thinking. We were gonna do in episode 208, one of the flashbacks we were talking about was, you know, he was maybe 20 and Mouse was maybe 15, is what we talked about for a long time. After talking to Ben, we're like, all right, we better make this like he's 30 and she's 25 because the technology can, and then as he said, start testing it. Yeah. So that really came out of Ben, and I think it works wonder, and it's so great that we have Ben and Zuleika in those flashbacks.
Yeah, yeah. It's also a function of, you know, who did what last year and how do we subvert that? Because last year, if you, you know, unfortunately, one of the problems with last season is that the script or the story by necessity kept pulling Marcus and Tomas in two different directions, because we had this conspiracy story to keep alive, but we also had the family story. And so since Tomas was sort of more built into the family story, he was sort of the point of entry there. Marcus kept getting pulled off to go investigate and go talk to homeless people and go search abandoned buildings and stuff like that.
Hanging out with the Rigos.
Yeah, and hanging out in trailers and looking at maps and stuff like that. And so we were like, okay, well, let's make sure that the characters are doing different things this year. So let's take Ben and give him a story arc this season that's less investigative and more emotional. Let's kind of dive into, you know, this guy had his collar taken away. There, 30 years of poverty and chastity and celibacy vows just got thrown out the window, and we never really explored that last year because there was just never time.
Right.
It felt like a disservice to come back and have this guy just be the cop who's always on duty, who never kind of takes a moment to himself. And so we knew that we wanted Marcus to kind of experience these milestones and go on this journey, which means that Tomas by necessity now needs to get slotted over here to this other storyline. So how do we bring him into contact with this family? How do we make sure that he is more emotionally invested in what's happening to this house? And well, we need to give him these visions. We need to have these visions. So that's how kind of we build this larger story over the season of him opening himself up to these demonic visions and letting these things inside his head. Part of it is because it gives us new visual language to play with in the show, but really it's to solve story problems.
Yeah.
It's us looking, where do we need to take Tomas over the course of this year, and what is the story engine we can use to have him hit point A, B, and C?
Yeah. Well, and it seems like it's sort of this holistic approach, right?
Yeah.
We're going to move this character forward over here and sort of touch on his emotional backstory, then what do we do with this character?
Exactly.
Because they joined,
and right.
Then the bigger story. It's an interesting how it comes together. Did it feel like a coming together, or was it?
It did.
Like,
I think so.
It does.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and I hope again, when you watch 210, you feel that it really comes together into one story.
Yeah,
that's great.
That it all is all these disparate storylines that are slowly being funneled until you get a satisfying ending.
It feels like, also, I mean, you guys had a great room. I know you had a great
amazing
room.
The best room. Amazing room. The best room. Fast, smart.
Yeah. There must have been. I mean, when you have a great room like that, there are so many ideas, right?
Yeah.
Was there stuff that got away? Were there things?
So much. You're saying the Peter storyline, Peter and Marcus.
Mm-hmm.
We intended that to be like three episodes long,
oh, wow.
A real, almost like he was going to go on a spiritual journey and maybe even like ayahuasca and really find his look for other because the God has given, God's not speaking to him, the Catholic Church, so he's going to find spirituality another way. He was going to go that direction with it, and it was going to be it was going to be a kiss. They were going to make love. There was going to be a whole physical interaction. And then a goodbye at the end of the thing. And basically we had time for, you know, I mean, we have three or four episodes, but it's very sparse because we just don't have time.
Right.
And John Cho's so good that we started having to say, well, we have this room. We don't have this room anymore because we want our priests to be with John Cho, to be with Andy Kim. We want those three together. So we didn't have time for some of the big storylines.
But a little also goes a long way.
It does.
I mean, you're saying so much, even if it is 2 minutes of screen time.
Right.
Right.
Because we haven't known anything. Like, we're ready to grab onto this character.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the biggest challenge for writing our show is that we essentially always have three A storylines, where your average show has an A story, a B story.
C runner, maybe.
Yeah, like Marcus and Tomas usually have their own story in each episode.
Right.
Even when they're together and they're dovetailing, usually they have their own story.
Yeah.
And then John Cho has his own A story for every episode. So you figure you have 42 and a half minutes per episode, and that's hard and fast. You can't go over and you can't go under. So you figure, you know, even if you give all three of your main characters 10 minutes each per episode, which isn't a lot at all. That still only leaves you with 13 minutes to divide between all the other B stories.
Right.
And in this case, for this season, we had 5 foster kids plus a love interest.
Yeah.
Mouse and Bennett?
And plus Mouse and Bennett.
Plus
and the entire conspiracy.
Yeah. Yes. Who has her own and wants a need.
Yeah. So that's 13 minutes per episode, basically, broken down to divide between all of that. Wow. And any time you go over that 13 minutes, it's going to detract from someone's story. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff that, you know, poor Father Bennett was one of the big casualties this year, just because every week we would sit there and bored, like, then Bennett goes to a pawn shop in Amsterdam and it gets surrounded on all sides by Vatican agents and there's a shootout and the building catches on fire, and then you start boarding the episode and it's like, oh, all we have time for is like
Bennett and Mouse down in the ossuary.
Yeah.
One scene.
Bennett has a conversation on an existing set.
Yeah.
And then walks out of the room. So you have to
We love Bennett. We absolutely love Bennett.
We love Kurt.
And if there's a season 3, I can't say anymore, but
We have big plans for Bennett. So it always becomes one of these things of like, you have to always be balancing which characters have you given a lot of stuff to and who is still owed it. Like, you look at our foster kids and like, Caleb was really prevalent in episode 1, didn't have as much to do in later episodes. Yeah. Shelby was really prevalent in 2, Harper was the lead in 3, Grace was all about 4. So we always kind of try to balance the kids. And once the kid, you know, unfortunately, once one of the kids got kind of their big centerpiece episode, they're kind of supporting characters going forward.
But then also, I mean, and I wonder if it's conscious or not, like, it kind of doesn't matter that they're supporting characters because they've gotten that. And you do this sort of haiku work, right?
Yeah.
Like, what's the smallest space I can say the most?
Yes, exactly. And once you have that emotional investment with the kid, a little bit goes a long way, because now you love them and you understand them and you're rooting for them.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily need to spend 25 minutes with each kid in every episode.
Yeah.
They become almost one character until we start killing them off.
Yes, until they all die in episode 9.
Well, listen, I was
we killed some in 10.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to make a joke about this, but like, that has to be a conversation. Right?
It's body count.
It has to be for real.
Sure. Yeah.
These are 5 kids.
Yeah.
Can we kill off kids in an episode? I guess we'll find out.
It's probably the central argument that we would have in the room, central conflict about who to kill and when to kill and what to. I mean, it's a horror. It's a horror.
Yeah.
So you have to have some sort of body count. And you want to.
Absolutely.
And things change quite a bit. I mean, there was the character Rose, played by Lily, she was dead for like a week. There was a point where episode 6, instead of Harper's mom being killed,
Rose.
The entire episode was Rose trying to get off the island, and at the very end, she's on the ferry going for help, and she turns around. Andy's there. He stabs her, dumps her.
She goes
through the propeller.
Back.
What?
The ocean turns red behind the boat, and that's the end of the episode.
Holy shit.
Because the demon caused so much chaos in season 1.
I got it.
Sort of lights again.
I got the light.
Because it caused so much chaos in season 1, it's like, well, if the demon comes back this year and everyone gets off scot-free just because it's a house full of kids, it's going to feel like we're pulling our punches. The audience is going to see behind the curtain. And so we started talking about who can conceivably die. How far can you take Andy and still have you rooting for this family to come back together and find a happy ending? So obviously in episode 9, he kind of puts those kids through the ringer and does some pretty horrific shit. And you know, there's more to come in episode 10.
Was it the question of how far can we push Andy that changed who died in that episode?
It wasn't. It was a question of us realizing that we really needed Rose for those remaining. It was also falling in love with Lily because once you see that first episode coming in and you realize how charming and personal, you're like, oh god, I can't put this person through a boat propeller.
She clearly had an arc. She came in, was playing an arc. She came in as the social worker, and she's the antagonist of the first episode as well. She really is the one that's coming to break up the family, and now we realize, oh, we have a full, we have an arc, which I can't go into too much in too depth, but she is clearly has the arc. Yeah, she has a big arc to play. That's
cool. And if you look at 208, you start to realize that at some point you know that Marcus and Tomas are going to be focused on this investigation, and if one adult is tied to a bed and the other one is chopped up into little pieces, who's watching these kids? We're either taking these neighbors and making them major characters, or Marcus and Tomas are babysitting, and like neither of
which
those.
Which I would watch a whole episode of.
Marcus telling Bible stories for impressionable children.
Anything you want in the fridge, guys, go for it.
Perfect. It'd be a great episode with those actors. You can absolutely watch them read the phone book.
I'd watch it. Yeah.
So now we know what to expect if there's a season three.
The phone book. The phone book babysitter.
You must have had conversations about if we get another season, here's stuff we're interested in. Do you want to talk about any of it?
You know, we've been talking about location because we would probably move it to another place. Like we were talking about Mexico City, perhaps. We've talked about Ireland, we've talked about Iceland, Prague, I mean, different places in America, Los Angeles, New Orleans.
One thing we didn't get to do this season, we talked about it last year and we didn't have time, and then we talked about it this year and we didn't have time, is bringing in other faiths and other religions.
Much more.
And it was always the game plan. We were going to bring in some First Nations storylines this season, and then unfortunately, as storylines expanded and contracted, we realized that it was going from like a 3-episode arc to a 1-episode arc to like now just a single scene. and when you start compressing stuff, it becomes cliche.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, we're going to have this guy come in and he's just going to seem like a bullshit shaman, Hollywood, holy man.
Yeah.
And it's going to seem like we didn't do our homework. And so we're like, oh, we'll save it for season 3. So we've said that 2 years in a row, but I think
if we
get a third season, it's owed. Like we've already kind of established that the Catholic Church has been infiltrated and turned and can no longer be trusted, which means if Marcus and Tomas are looking for allies in this larger fight, they're going to have to reach outside the church, and we're going to have to start seeing how other people fight back against these same forces using very different methodologies.
That's really cool.
Yeah. We had Rabbi Stein as a character.
Rabbi Stein was in there
for like 6 weeks. Rabbi Stein mentioned. I think it was on the board. I think someone even tweeted it out, Rabbi Stein. That's it became like 3 episodes and it became 1. And then, if we're not really going to get into Judaism, then we can't. It'd be bullshit to do it.
For a period, even the episode 3 storyline with Harper, the little standalone where it turns out to be a Munchausen by proxy illness, we were talking about like, ooh, is that our chance to do like bring in some Jewish Orthodox mysticism and bring in some Dybbuks and different names for sort of the same primal malevolent forces. Yeah. And the problem is you start compressing it and it's like, oh, well because Harper's mom turns out to be evil, are you now saying something negative about Judaism compared to Catholicism?
And it becomes complicated in a bad way.
It's one of those things where you can do it for the right reasons and it comes across in the worst possible way.
But it seems like also by pushing it, like, now is the time to do it, right? Like, you've sort of built up this mythology, you've built up these characters, and now we get to push out at the world a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a great idea.
You have to keep expanding the sandbox, because if every year was just showing up and here's another family in another house and
they come in and
chant for 10 episodes and then walk off into the sunset, I think some fatigue would set in.
I like your Mad Magazine version that you've just described. Catholics come in, they chant. Finale is on this Friday night.
It's Friday.
Yes.
On Fox. People should check it out. And they can go watch, and it's on Hulu.
Hulu. Hulu the next day. Netflix Canada.
And I think on the Fox website, you can catch up on most of the episodes.
And people really should. I've been saying it for
Please watch all 10. Binge them. Yeah. They're great to binge.
They really are. It's true. I mean, look, It's the best network drama we've got. It feels like a cable show that people love. Before we wrap up, let me ask you guys, I know you've been busy all year, but have you had time to watch television? Is there stuff that you have enjoyed? Is there stuff you want to recommend?
The Good Place is my favorite show.
The best.
The Good Place is awesome.
The Good Place is amazing. The end of season 1 is one of my favorite episodes of all time of television. And people need to watch that.
I haven't seen, like, I still haven't seen Stranger Things. I still haven't seen Leftovers.
Oh, I saw the second episode of Stranger Things. That's how slow it is when you're in TV and you're working 16 hours a day.
Well, that's a binge for you.
Yeah,
you
it is. Year, oh, I can't wait. I can't wait for Stranger Things. It's great. The first two episodes are great.
I thought Leftovers season 3, though, was one of the best things I've ever seen on TV.
I keep hearing this.
I thought it was... I thought season 1 was okay, and I thought season 2 was a huge improvement. I thought season 3 was one of those mythical, perfect seasons of television. It was the most ambitious, most emotionally resonant thing I've seen in a long time.
Can I just watch season 3?
You could, but you will get a lot more. It's the most ambitious long form storytelling I've ever seen on a TV show. So that was it. Leftovers in particular was a huge inspiration for me coming in to season 2. Just they have big conceptual episodes in season 2 and season 3 where they really break the box, and that's why we kind of came in and pushed for our episode 7, where the whole thing is from the perspective of the possessed. I was like, god damn it, Leftovers had this episode that I can't shake where they just stepped outside and swung for the fences. We have to do it. Like, if this is our last season, we've got to have that one big swing. Like, that's the best thing I've seen.
That's great. Well, and hopefully that kind of give and take is happening more and more. Like, we who are making TV are responding to other people making TV and movies and books and things, and get inspired by those good ideas.
We all keep elevating each other.
I really
feel we are doing that.
Yeah, there was that bullshit article that came out how, like, now that House of Cards is over, the golden age of TV has ended. And I'm like, shut the fuck up. TV has never been better.
It keeps getting better.
It's more an embarrassment of riches. There's you know, Godless just came out, and there's a 10-hour Scott Frank Western just sitting there waiting for me that I don't have time to watch. And you're saying the golden age is over? Shut the fuck up.
It's impossible.
There's 1,000 hours of amazing stuff to watch.
And there are more places to watch them, which means more places to buy them. And it's an exciting time to be in.
Yeah, it's the best time.
Thank you guys so much for chatting with
me. Awesome. Thank you very much. Thanks for watching. Thanks for being a fan.
Thanks.
Really appreciate it.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.